Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Hi, this is Billie Jean King.
This is Marion Bartoli.
I'm Mats Wilander.
This is Mary Carillo.
This is Pam Shriver.
I'm Stan Wawrinka.
I'm Leighton Hewitt.
This is Yannick Noah, and you're listening to the Tennis Podcast.
Well, how we've all managed to get on the same podcast together tonight is something that has rather mystified me, because Catherine seems to have been working around the clock for two straight weeks and has just done another wonderful shift of work, this time for Amazon Prime Video, talking about the tennis in Canada. Matt just sort of fits in and around Catherine and myself. I don't really know how he's coping, and I've just come to Portugal for a week, so I'm sitting in the lobby at the moment with some gentle music playing in the background that maybe only I can hear, but I have
you've deliberately sat in a really unglamorous location, David, in as an act of sensitivity.
I have.
Towards my very irrational self,
yeah,
and my unreasonable rules about the sending of glamorous holiday photos to the group chat.
I've sent zero. Matt actually requested one today.
Yeah, you can send it privately.
I did. Anyway, yes, it's horrible here, Catherine.
I'm more okay with indoor photos.
Mm. Okay, well, I
just don't want to see outdoor photos. I don't want to see a pool. Okay. I don't want to see a beach. I don't want to see the sun.
No problem.
But
it's 1:15 in the morning. I can take one.
David Law smiling with a beer in a restaurant.
Yeah, not
with
happening.
Assorted family members. I can handle that.
Oh, can you? Oh, right. I'll go and wake them
up.
Yeah, fine. Because at the moment I'm sat here in an empty lobby with a wall behind me just for you, and yes, I'll be getting a photo of it.
It looks like you're in a hostage video. I really appreciate it, David.
You're welcome. That's what 14 years of friendship and professional companionship does for you. Right, well, let's talk about tennis, shall we? How are we both? We're all right. You've just done a day of Canada, Catherine. What's it look like from? I know you're in a studio in London, but what does it look like witnessing these two tournaments, I guess, for the first time with the same rights holders? Because it was supposed to be last year, wasn't it? And yet it didn't happen.
Yeah, well, from a broadcasting point of view, it still feels like a massive luxury to have the rights to both. And actually, this is the first time we've, done. I mean, well, Canada is unique, isn't it, with the concurrent men's and women's. And we've talked before about, I think we all just really love that format. I really love the two cities, the alternating between men's and women's, each of them. I think that's brilliant. And yeah, it just feels like a massive luxury, the darting around and knowing that there'll always be a decent match to go to. I mean, I'm sure at some point in the week there will be an inevitable downside of, you know, having to sacrifice showing one great match in favour of another. But, you know, they're all available to view on the platform, at least. I love these tournaments. I particularly love Montreal. I've been there twice, and was there 2 years ago, the last time the tournament was held. Of course, it was a men's event then, and I love the city. I love, yeah, the hospitality of that tournament. It's really right up there as one of my favourites. I've got very happy sort of Medvedev emerging memories of 2 years ago. It was the first time I sort of remember thinking, oh, he could be quite interesting. it's great. I have to keep stopping myself from sort of accidentally talking about weightlifting.
Because that's what you, that's what you've been doing for Eurosport.
Not exclusively weightlifting.
Just out of the blue weightlifting.
Thankfully for the viewers.
I've been to Montreal and Toronto for the tournaments, but both the ATP tournaments. I didn't do the WTA tournaments, I don't think. 2003 was the first time for Montreal, and it was won by Andy Roddick just a couple of weeks before he went on and won the US Open.
He won the double, didn't he?
Yeah.
With Brad Gilbert.
He did indeed.
Gosh, I remember watching that. Did you, David, dangle off the CN Tower, though?
No. I mean, there wouldn't be much point. I'd have been on the ground before you know it. But
they generally don't let that happen.
No.
Which is what I explained to my mum after I sent her the video of me dangling off the top of the CN Tower.
Right. Was it good?
Well, it's very easy to say after the fact. I'm very glad I did it. I thought I was going to be a rock star. Like, yeah, did this really gnarly thing. Got a really gnarly picture. Wasn't that cool? And actually, I involuntarily began sobbing in the lift on the way up and couldn't stop sobbing all the way around.
Okay.
And I was with people that I didn't know that well and that I still have to see.
Okay. Right.
Yeah.
Well, then I went to Toronto in 2010. So only the one time I've been there. And that was a tournament which was won by Andy Murray. And I think he might have beaten Nadal and Federer back-to-back to win it, is my recollection. Crikey.
It was the big four in the semis. One of the quite few times that actually happened. I think you sort of think that they always reach the semi-finals of every tournament. But that was actually quite a rare thing that they were all there. And yeah, Murray came out on top, didn't he?
Yeah, blimey.
That's just reeled that off.
Yeah, I was going to say, I'm the one who was there. And I'm sort of just about vaguely recalling that might have happened. And Matt's got the actual stat. And by the way, Djokovic was there as well. Matt, how are you? You all right?
Very well, thank you. Yes. And I just wanted to say, Catherine, I think you've done a fantastic job of not mixing up Toronto and Montreal all day. I feel like that is a big challenge this week.
It is, isn't it?
I had a sketch pad in front of me on which I actually wrote the words T for testosterone to try and remember that the men were in Toronto and the women were in Montreal. I just couldn't make it stick. My head was swirling with thoughts of modern pentathlon and canoe slalom, and I just couldn't fix it in my brain. And the PA Sarah came over, talked back, and said, "Just remember T for testosterone." And it got me through the day. So thank you for remarking upon that.
What did she have for M?
Well, once you've got T for testosterone, then the logical conclusion is M for women.
Okay, that works. Right, let's talk about the actual tennis, shall we? And there's been lots of it. I think we'll start with them. I mean, just for a start, the event today, the match I saw was Dan Evans being beaten handily by Alexander Bublik, who looked brilliant, I thought. I mean, he looked as though, and he still seemed to be playing within himself. He's this guy we're so used to hitting trick shots and outrageous stuff, and that was as close to a percentage play full of rallies sending him to victory that I can remember. But the other half of the story was that Dan Evans didn't look anything like his normal self. Is that about right?
Yeah, this one, I found this quite difficult to analyse from a public point of view, because yes, he did look really dialed in and never really wavered in that, which I'm not sure is something I've ever properly seen before. But equally, I thought Dan Evans looked a shadow of himself, really. There was no exuberance in him. There was no scrappiness, and there just seemed to be no resilience there. And yes, he's a very stylish player, but actually what wins him the matches is all of those things rather than the stylishness. And take them away and he can look quite ordinary, and so outgunned. It can look so out of his depth, I think. And that's a little bit what he looked like today. I'm quite sure he'll get it back. You know, it seems, you know, it's clear cause and effect. I think he's had COVID, and okay, he's recovered from COVID now, but that doesn't mean it hasn't taken a lot out of his training and really disrupted his preparation for an extremely grueling portion of the season. The conditions in both Toronto and Montreal actually look incredibly Tokyo-esque. It must be just heart-sinking territory for the players that were in Tokyo and thought, thank goodness I've got out of that cauldron of fire, and then arrive in Canada, and it seems to be kind of identical conditions, that suffocating humidity. I interviewed Jo Konta in her hotel room this evening and asked her about the conditions, and she said, yeah, it's really sweaty.
Yeah, there were three retirements, weren't there, today in Montreal?
Yeah, three in Montreal, and we saw a number of players on court getting their blood pressure checked today, getting their pulse taken, their blood pressure checked, getting their breathing monitored. So, yeah, look, I've no doubt Dan Evans will get it back. I think it's a bit of an unknown quantity how long this will take, and that must be very, very disconcerting for him. Mm. I think it must be quite a troubling time for him, I'd imagine.
And difficult to get matches, of course, at the moment, because you're playing really good players at the ranking he's at. I mean, I think it was, we'll go on to talk about Washington, the tournament that took place last week in a minute, but he lost to him 7-6-6 love against Brandon Nakashima, who's had a great couple of weeks and reached finals. But still, that's two first round losses, and you know, that's no cause for alarm in terms of losing a couple of matches as such. It's more that, as you said, he had COVID straight after Wimbledon. It did knock him about. It stopped him training, and I'm sure this is the case for a lot of players, that it just becomes really difficult to get yourself back up to speed against players who haven't had it. Yeah, it's. I do remember some days in Montreal when I was there, could be just blisteringly hot. Others were full of thunderstorms and lashing rain. We'll find out what the effects are over the next week in those couple of tournaments, which are being played without Roger Federer and Novak Djokovic in them. From a men's perspective in Toronto, and now we've learnt today that Cincinnati is also going to be without both of them. We knew for a few days that was the case for Roger Federer. He had decided that he wasn't going to be able to play either, which I think has to be a real concern. He cited the knee as the reason for it, and he talked about a setback with that ahead of the Olympics, which he pulled out of. Djokovic today has said what was painfully obvious to anybody watching Tokyo, that he's exhausted, he needs more time with his family to rest up and get ready. I still think it makes for a very interesting additional element to the story over the next few weeks as to whether the fact that other players are building momentum whilst he's got his feet up makes any difference whatsoever.
I thought you were going to say whether he's going to play Winston-Salem.
Well, I don't think it's out of the question. I don't think he will, personally.
I think it's out of the question. Matt?
Yeah, I think so. I think in his statement he basically said, see you in New York. It is interesting, though. It does add an extra element of intrigue into what is already a fascinating story at the US Open. It strikes me that two things need to happen in New York for Djokovic to lose. And one of those is Djokovic being below par. And I think the stress of what he's trying to achieve could cause that. I think that's possible. The other thing is if he doesn't have his form and just isn't playing well. And look, he didn't play well to finish the Olympics. He needs to rediscover the form he had earlier in the summer. I think in terms of someone being able to beat him, the thing is, there's only really a handful of players, I would have thought, that he could draw in the first couple of rounds that would trouble him. You know, I think Kyrgios would be outside the seeds. A guy like Fritz, who we've mentioned.
Can you imagine?
I mean,
Kyrgios Djokovic first round.
It's all I'm imagining. You know, but they just aren't the threats, I don't think. And I think that is probably a, you know, part of the reason why he feels comfortable doing this. He backs himself to rediscover the form and to get through those first few rounds of the US Open and to get into that tournament. He knows himself. He's won slams before when he's not had a lead-in event. It's got to be the right decision.
Yeah. I think it's the right decision as well. I mean, I suppose I immediately look at it and just think, wow, you know, not playing a lead-in tournament. But effectively, everything he's been playing is a lead-in tournament because he's been playing so much. And this is just the ultimate refresher, isn't it? Recharge of batteries. And he's done it before. He went to Wimbledon without playing on grass before it, and he won it a couple of
Australia
times.
Australia too.
Yeah. Yes, of course. And I don't know, I just think that he is... The worst thing that can happen to him is he be in any way tired or, you know, jaded. And he looked that immediately in that moment where the match turned against Verov. It was like a sudden moment where it just all gone, all of his energy. And he needs the maximum available to him. Federer is just an extension of what we were discussing at Wimbledon, I think. That he is in a... I think he's probably in a bad way. And I can't see him playing the US Open. Maybe that's wrong. I just cannot see it. And therefore, who knows whether he can get himself match fit again. Guess we'll see. But it just seems too much of a stretch to me. Either of you think differently?
I think there's a scenario in which this setback, this admission that he can't play any lead-up tournament to the US Open, which essentially is an admission that he can't challenge for the US Open, even if he were physically able to play, I think. Maybe that is the Rubicon crossed in terms of it being the end. In which case, then the decision is, do I play the US Open just to play one last US Open and one last Grand Slam and feel like I'm going out on my own terms? Now, our inkling, based on, you know, sort of loose intel, but nothing firm or in particular, is that he intends to go out at the Laver Cup. Possibly this Laver Cup. Probably this Laver Cup. And perhaps that makes playing one last Grand Slam less significant, less important? I don't know, but that I certainly don't think if he plays the US Open, it would be because he thinks he can win the US Open. I think he must have accepted in his mind now that that's not what tennis this season is about anymore, sounds like to me. I mean, that's a dreadfully sad thing to say, but I fear it's true.
That what you think, Matt?
Yeah, it is exactly what I think. Look, Federer's knee has been a huge problem over these last 18 months, even going back to all the setbacks last year when he had to have the additional surgery, when we heard he wasn't really playing much, when he couldn't make Australia at the start of the year, even though it was delayed, and when he came back and he was citing those fitness concerns in Doha, and he only managed three matches at Roland Garros, and he lost a 6-love set at Wimbledon. You know, none of it has been particularly positive, really. I mean, it was a triumph that he got to the quarterfinals at Wimbledon, that he was out there playing as he did, but he looks a million miles from challenging to win Grand Slam titles, which he was doing in 2019, the last time he played a full season. So, absolutely, I think, you know, the game has changed for him now, and it, at the moment, it's certainly not about trying to win the US Open. And if he does play, yeah, I think that could well be a sign that he just wants one more Grand Slam appearance. As things stand, I think there's going to be full capacity crowds in New York. I think that's a big deal for him. I think he would be able to have his family with him. These are all important factors that might make him play. I think if he doesn't play the US Open, it could still mean that he's thinking of going out at the Laver Cup, or, you know, it could possibly mean he's thinking longer term and really trying to get the knee back to health. I just don't have that much faith that that can happen, given the 18 months that I've just laid out there, but we'll see.
Well, we wish him as swift and full a recovery as he can get from that knee injury. And he's turned 40 years of age in the last few days, which is a milestone, having been through it and closer to the other one. I know that. It's a heck of an age to still be even contemplating a career of the type of physicality required for players like him and Serena and Venus Williams to be doing what they're doing. But we will see. We'll see what happens next. What about the rest of Toronto and Montreal? What are the stories in the absence of those two and Serena Williams? What are the stories? Who really springs to mind?
Simona Halep is back. We've not seen her for a few months. I'm quite excited to see her again. And I think she's just dropped out of the top 10 for the first time in several years. She's been one of the most consistent players in WTA history, really, in terms of sustaining that top 10 ranking. You know, really unlucky injury that took her out of three massive tournaments. So I'm pleased that she's back. And I think Bianca Andreescu is another big one, the sort of defending champion, really. She won in Toronto, wasn't it, in 2019, and this is the first time the event's being played again, and we spoke about the struggles she was having through the clay and the grass and bubble life. We've had confirmation that Coco is on site, which basically means she's going to win the tournament.
Visual confirmation.
This is Andreescu's dog, right?
Mm.
Yes. Who Catherine people had a selfie with.
The people know, David. Come on. for me, Andreescu is the big story in Montreal. You know, she's so responded to playing in front of a home crowd when she won 2 years ago. She's working with Sven Groeneveld now on a trial basis. I'm very interested in that and the boost that it can give her. And yeah, look, I know it's been a a really stuttering and frustrating comeback for her. She must have had some real lows. I know she's all about the positivity and mindfulness, but she must have had some real lows this year, not just, you know, having a marching band stroke up to sing you happy birthday moments after you've just lost a crushing tennis match. You know, she's had COVID and she's had hard quarantine and, you know, the turning her ankle in the final of Miami, you know, it's just been heartbreak after heartbreak. But I'm wary of raising expectations too high for her, but, you know, she could do with some results now. She really could. I know she's still extremely young, but before you know, the scar tissue, the baggage, it builds up, doesn't it? She could just do with getting on a roll, and it feels like a big week. Crowds, okay, not huge crowds, but some home crowd to spur her on. I think she's fit. I'm touching wood as I say that, but I think she's fit, and you know, maybe the new coach bounce. I hope those things, plus obviously Coco, can create the sort of perfect recipe for her to not necessarily win the thing, but just start something.
Yeah, you're right about, I think you're right, she does need to get on something of a roll and start to feel like the tennis player she was 2 years ago, because that just inevitably hasn't been possible because of all the breaks, most of them beyond her control. But yeah, it can be difficult on the tour, especially with a tour as deep and full of quality players as the WTA circuit, to be able to get any momentum going. But she's good enough, that much we do know. Just on the subject of the crowds, does that mean there are full crowds? Because I noticed it was absolutely empty in the Evans Bublik match, and I don't think that was just them not appealing to people. That was curfew. Am I right?
So, in Toronto, a crowd of around 4,600 is allowed in the main stadium. No, they're not allowed to go anywhere else in the ground, so all outside courts are crowdless. 4,600 in the main stadium, but then there's this curfew of approximately 5 p.m. So in between the second and third matches on centre court, the stadium was emptied. So the preceding match on centre court, actually a really good match, slightly bizarre, but a really good one, Fabio Fognini against Jan-Lennard Struff, which Fognini won despite being sort of dead man walking for a set and a half. The crowd was told to go home after that match, and then Dan Evans played to an empty stadium.
I felt like there were some fans that had come back in to Evans versus Bublik at the end of the match. There was a smattering of people there, and I think that there is a night session crowd in Toronto. I'm pretty sure.
Right, so it's two separate swathes of 4,600 people, but they have to make sure that they don't
overlap
cross paths.
At all.
Right.
I think
right.
That could be the situation. It's weird, but we're used to weird.
Yeah. Yeah.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
The other thing we should say that there is to look forward to is Rafael Nadal being in action in Toronto. It's fantastic to see him. We can talk as well now about what we saw last week in Washington, which were full crowds and which were Nadal just whipping them into a frenzy, which was a real reminder of what full crowds in America can be like and what Nadal can, the effect he can have on a full crowd, because we've just been without that, because he didn't play Wimbledon. He hasn't played many tournaments with lots and lots of people present in recent months. And it was great to see in his match against Jack Sock that he managed to win from a breakdown in the final set. It was vintage Rafa in that respect, but blimey, the tennis generally and his physicality were not.
Even on the practice court, he was whipping them into a frenzy, David. I think we've all seen a clip that was doing the rounds on Twitter of a local reporter in Washington doing a piece to camera with Nadal behind him on the practice court, just about Nadal coming to Washington for the first time. And he was absolutely shitting the bed about Nadal being in Washington. He was losing his mind on live television about it. It was sort of adorable. It's a crowd-pleasing thing for Nadal to have done, to go and play in Washington.
It was a really cool reciprocal relationship. I felt that, you know, Nadal loved being there and they loved having him. They really sort of rolled out the red carpet for him and gave him this incredible reception. And we also
did a load
got
of sightseeing.
I was going to say, we also got my new favourite Nadal, which is tourist Nadal.
Misidentifying Washington monuments.
Yeah, mixing up the Capitol and the White House, posting a picture of him wearing a bicycle helmet on top of his cap. It was all brilliant and adorable.
Yeah, looking startled with dogs in the street.
Mm.
It was great Instagram Nadal last week.
Yes, and someone commented, "You've mixed up the Capitol and the White House," and he just replied, "Yes."
Uh-huh. Oh, so fun. I was just saying, yes, a limited number of fans, roughly 5,000, are allowed per session.
Back on this.
Catherine, in
Toronto. We exhausted this, David. We definitely exhausted it.
Okay. What's the deal, Matt, with this foot issue that Nadal has? Because he lost his match, his second round match that he ended up playing, and didn't look in great shape.
Well, the foot is a problem area for Nadal. I think, you know, right back at the start of his career, it almost ended his career before it really started. I think they were really struggling to control the pain in his foot. And my understanding is it was kind of a last resort, the solution they ended up finding for that foot. And, he's played his whole career with implants in his shoes and he has managed some pain in that area. And I think anyone who watched that fourth set of his loss to Djokovic at Roland Garros, you could see he was limping. He wasn't moving freely in that fourth set. I don't think it was necessarily the reason he lost, and I think he was outplayed on that day by Djokovic, but there was clearly an issue for him there, and he subsequently, as we know, pulled out of Wimbledon and the Olympics, and he gave some quotes saying that he's not really been able to train as pain-free as he would like in these last couple of months since Roland Garros. He's had ongoing issues and it hasn't healed as quickly as he would like. And I think particularly that sock match that you mentioned in Washington, again, he was very visibly limping and struggling with it. And then He said it was a bit better for his match against Lloyd Harris, which he actually lost. He beat Sock and then lost to Lloyd Harris in Washington, both three set matches. I think his tennis was up and down, as it has been all season, really. He's not been quite vintage Nadal this season. He has had some slightly odd matches, but you know, it was his first time playing in a while, and I think the consensus was that his tennis was okay, but this foot is a problem, and he needs it to get better quite quickly, because otherwise he's in a race against time for the US Open, which obviously is the big goal for him over the next month or so. But yeah, I think it's going to be very interesting to watch him over the next few weeks. It wasn't the sort of ravenous Nadal, kind of like a caged animal, that I was thinking he might be after a couple of months on the sidelines with everyone else really pushing through Wimbledon and the Olympics, and he was sort of raring to go. That is not the situation we're in. There are some doubts about Nadal's fitness as well, and yeah, let's just hope that foot does clear up.
And his opening match in Toronto is going to be against the guy that beat him less than a week ago in Washington. He's got to play Lloyd Harris again.
Oh, that's must-see TV, isn't it? Because Harris won his match tonight, I saw in your coverage, Catherine. And he is a coming man, isn't he? He has really put it together this year.
Yeah, and yet I still keep forgetting about him somehow.
Yeah, no, I know what you mean there. I feel like he's somebody who warrants attention more than what I feel like I give him, really.
But is it that... I was trying to compare him to Bublik earlier, where I feel like Bublik is really in my consciousness, has really forced himself into my consciousness this year, kind of week in, week out. You know, he's showing up, he's there, he seems to always be involved in a match that is sort of notable or significant in some way. And I just, of course, there have been notable results and weeks for Lloyd Harris this week, of course, this year, last week against Nadal, of course, that week in Dubai where he reached the final. And yes, I have adjusted my where I fit him into the scheme of things somewhat this year, and yet I don't have nearly as many Lloyd Harris memories of 2021 as I do Bublik memories.
Don't you think that says more about Bublik, though, perhaps?
Yeah, maybe I've just picked the wrong bloke to compare him to. But long story short, why don't I have more Lloyd Harris why haven't we created more memories together?
I don't know.
But, I realise I've asked a very, very difficult question.
But yeah, I mean, I think the thing is he's been an opponent for a lot of players and put up good shows against a lot of people without necessarily winning the big ones yet. And I mean, you know, he's been in all these first round draws and won a match or two, but he hasn't had runs apart from that Dubai tournament when he so memorably beat Denis Shapovalov in the semi-finals, which felt like a really big moment for both of them, really. And ended up losing to Karatsev in the final, didn't he, Harris, in Dubai. But I know, I think this is a real statement. I know it's against a subpar, sub-fit Nadal, but you've still got to do it, and you've got to not choke, and he managed to do it. So it's one of the really interesting matches coming up, the fact that he's playing him again. So we'll watch that with interest.
Yes, it's a bit of a Kanyas-Federer situation in 2007, isn't it, where he gets a shot at the same bloke again, and let's see if the result's any different.
Mm. Yes, indeed.
I was going to say a Fucsovics-Rublev situation, but you've come up with a far more eye-catching example.
Matt's just gone back the 14 years, you know.
Yeah.
Just picked it straight out. Brilliant. The other person that we were talking about a lot earlier on in this year because of his results at Challenger tournaments was Jenson Brooksby, the young American player, who has now broken into the world's top 100 and had a fantastic run in Washington He beat John Millman for the loss of about two games or three games. I was trying to think, well, what happened in that match? So I went back and watched the highlights of it today. And I don't even think Millman's playing badly. I think it is just a measure of how clever a match player Brooksby is and how talented he is. The array of shots he's got to discomfort a solid baseliner. I mean, I'm quite sure it's only really because Andy Murray has drawn attention to him that makes me think that he looks and plays like Andy Murray that I'm thinking that. But when I have gone and watched it today, it's uncanny to me how similar it is, the way he goes about his business, what he's trying to do to an opponent, the way he's hitting off-pace shots and drop shots out of nowhere, probably a few too many of them, but they're devastating. And then he's got this ability to draw somebody into the net and hit a passing shot on the run, which looks impossible. And he just tied John Millman up in knots, frankly, today or a few days ago. He ended up getting to the semi-finals. He lost a tight first set to Yannick Sinner, who went on to win the whole thing, and then a comfortable second set. But Brooksby was really interesting. I mean, this is what Murray tweeted about him out of nowhere, in the way that Andy Murray does sometimes. Jenson Brooksby is the sort of player I love to watch. Lots of variety, high tennis IQ, great in defence. His slice and backhand volley are almost identical to Florian Meyer, says Andy Murray.
I'm glad you found that as funny as I did.
Yeah, it reminds me of when I did that Queen's quiz with him, and I asked him, I can't remember what the question was, but his speculative answer was Sheng Shalken.
Brilliant.
As if anyone's thought about Sheng Shalken in the last 15 years.
I do like the fact that Aiden has chosen to reply to Andy Murray with, just don't say that he's going to be a future number one. We know how that ends. To which Andy Murray has replied...
Murray took Aiden to task.
He's replied, yeah, he might get to number four in singles and number one in doubles. That would be awful. So Chippy Andy Murray on Twitter is a marvellous sight. Don't know how Andy Murray
he
is.
He doesn't Hope do things right. by halves, does he? He's decided to go back to Twitter, and he's definitely gone back to Twitter.
He has. Yeah. And he likes Jenson Brooksby, and I can really understand why. The guy is good to watch.
Yeah, totally. I mean, he blew away all the opponents he faced up until the semi-finals. In addition to Millman, he beat Kevin Anderson, Francis Tiafoe, and Felix Auger-Aliassime, and that was the match I watched. And yeah, I just found it so interesting, because on the one hand, you've got Auger-Aliassime, who is so smooth and has this perfect technique and just looks like a great tennis player. He's got that lithe physique. And then the other end of the court, you've got Brooksby, who's just a little bit rougher around the edges and has a slightly odd technique and doesn't look completely polished, and yet he was the one who had the winning game plan, and he thoroughly outplayed Auger-Aliassime. Just great anticipation, moving him over the court. As you said, he's got that disguised drop shot, which he sort of hits with two hands on the backhand, and just at the last minute takes his hand off it. He's really interesting, and yeah, he's won, I think, three titles on the Challenger Tour. And just whenever a young player does that, I just think you just need to take note, because clearly they have a winning chip there. They have something that's ingrained. They know how to win tennis matches. And yes, it's a big step up to start doing that at the ATP level ahead of the Challenger level. But he's transitioned pretty well already. He reached the final in Newport as well, this run in Washington. He's sort of already arrived. And I think we'll be seeing a lot more of him.
Be interesting to see whether coaches and other players can figure out patterns that trouble him, and whether his slightly odd-looking technique on some strokes is something they can exploit. Because at the moment, it feels very much as though he's doing stuff to them and things that they're not expecting, which is great to watch. So I do recommend having a look at him if you haven't seen him yet. Yannick Sinner was the man who ended up winning the title in Washington. Beat Mackenzie McDonald 7-5, 4-6, 7-5. I've only seen brief highlights of this, but it sounded as though it was an absolute belter of a match. And the biggest win of Sinner's life in terms of titles.
Yeah, and I think it's quite an important win, actually. He hadn't had a particularly good few months, really, had he, on the grass, and then he lost his first round in Atlanta, I saw, to Chris O'Connell. And, you know, you're just thinking, kind of like what we were saying with Andreescu, he needs a result, he needs to get something going.
Four-match losing streak.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, really? So, you know, it wasn't panic stations, but he'd just gone quiet, and you don't want that to become a problem and something that continues. So for him to put this week together in Washington, I think he only lost one set, and that was in the final against McDonald. And yeah, it was a fun match. I think it took him 11 set points to win the first set, and then 5-2 up in the decider, he lost that lead and eventually got over the line 7-5. I think it's impressive from him. He's changed his service technique, and that had seemed to be paying dividends. I think a lot of the pundits you hear talk about Sinner over the last year, they've all said he can get more out of his serve. You know, he's brilliant from the baseline, and he's got good movement, but that serve, he needs more free points. He needs to back it up better, and I think he started doing that in Washington. So that's a good sign, and perhaps, you know, he's probably made use of some of the extra training time he's had, you know, having not gone in so deep in these tournaments, perhaps. I think I read he's the youngest winner of a ATP 500 event since they recategorized them. When was that? About 2009?
Wow. That's a good achievement.
I mean, he seemed really unbothered by it. He said, you know, youngest ever, first ever, doesn't matter to me. And I think that does sort of illustrate his approach. I think he's very sort of just process driven and, you know, kind of like Nadal a little bit in that sense. But, you know, for us, that's a big deal, Sinner being the youngest to achieve something. That just points to him being ahead of the curve, as we've thought of
him. He looked like the veteran against Brooksby. Is how they looked to on the court at the handshake, which is comical to think about given Sinner's tender years. But I mean, he's already starting to build towards those, what was it, couple of hundred matches that Ricardo Piatti says he needs to be playing before he can be considered a proper pro. He just keeps on playing. He plays a lot, and he doesn't seem to suffer necessarily from playing a lot at the moment. Hopefully that continues. The guy he beat in the final, Mackenzie McDonald, just a word for him, because there's a guy, another one a little bit like Lloyd Harris, doesn't get a lot of airtime in terms of conversation, but he keeps on turning up and playing really good matches. He's obviously a good player.
Yeah, my main memory of Mackenzie McDonald was commentating or reporting and doing brief stints of commentary on him beating Milos Raonic at Wimbledon, or being in the fourth round of Wimbledon, I think, in 2018, and a real surprise package, and yet still nobody talking about him. Because he has had results and upsets and made impacts, and yet still nobody talks about him. He's just there, and he doesn't seem to mind that nobody's talking about him ever. Or maybe he does mind, and I'm. there's a lot to respect there, I think, about Mackenzie McDonald.
I mean, he also managed to come past Nick Kyrgios, followed by Benoit Paire in the first two rounds of Washington, and then beat Kei Nishikori 7-5 in the third, in the semifinals, to get his place in the final. And then he was so close. I mean, some of the rallies that him and Sinner were playing were absolutely spectacular. Really do recommend having a watch of him as well. He's good value. And as you said, Wimbledon fourth round, you're quite right, Catherine, in 2018. And I'm just seeing who he ended up playing there. He was defeated in four sets by Milos Raonic in the round of 16.
There we go.
So Catherine pulls it out of the bag.
Well, sort of. I think I originally said that he beat Raonic.
Yeah.
What I meant was he won a set against Raonic.
Pretty good going, I reckon. Talking of pretty good going, that is something that we can be saying about Daniel Collins a lot at the moment, because he's just won two successive tournaments. I think it's a 10-match winning streak for her. Victory in the tournament in San Jose, that's the biggest tournament win of her life. I mean, it's the second one in as many weeks, the only two she's won in her career. But what a turnaround from somebody who has played very well. We've loved watching her. She's had a semi-final run to the Australian Open, but to never have won a title and then to win two in 2 weeks is a heck of an achievement. And I mean, some of the stuff that she was playing against Daria Kasatkina last night in a 6-3, 6-7, 6-1 win in the final was just vintage Collins. I mean, first of all, I was a bit surprised at just how hard she hits the ball when she's really going for it. I mean, it was relentless stuff. And at one stage, a stat popped up, 3 games all first set, and she'd hit 15 winners to one of Kasatkina's, and yet it was 3 games all in the first set. There were some magnificent outbursts in the first set of the come-on variety from Collins. And something that has since surfaced, which isn't available in the WTA official edited highlights of the match, are some of the GIFs, some of the little outtakes of...
I mean, that is a crime that this isn't available.
Yes. Thankfully, yeah. Twitter came
the
to the rescue.
The highlight. To suggest that anything is a higher light than this moment is criminal.
Yes. Well, one of our dear listeners drew my attention to the fact that an outburst had happened, and I'm thinking, well, I've just watched the 8 minutes of edited highlights on the WTA website and nothing happened other than her shouting, come on, so what are you talking about? Well, I did notice at that point that the entire second set tiebreak, which seemed to be 22 points long and within which Collins had had about 5 match points, was missing. That just wasn't in the highlights. And so I was wondering, well, what's gone on? And then this GIF surfaced from, I think, the Twitter account, Tennis GIFs or something like that.
It's a GIF you'll be seeing a lot of, yes. David.
And how can I best describe it? Catherine, would you like to describe it? I think you could probably do a better job than me.
Well, the GIF is obviously mute, as GIFs are. But what she's saying is, oh, shut up.
And she's saying it to somebody in the crowd who's apparently been heckling her. And the withering look on her face and the lingering...
It is...
element.
And the eyes flutter with rage at the end of the gif.
Shut
My bar up. For all of those things, withering looks... eyes fluttering with all of those things. My bar is high, and she's just vaulted over it like Holly Bradshaw.
Full respect to Holly Bradshaw. I think she's gold medal material, Danielle Collins.
Vaulted over it like that American woman that won the gold in the pole vault, whose name I've already forgotten.
Yes.
Well, just for my mum's sake, a GIF is like a little video. Yes, it was...
I've already sworn on this podcast, David, we've already alienated your mum. I'm sorry. I'm sorry, Mrs. Law. I've had one extremely weak watered-down whiskey, and I've sworn all over the podcast.
it was a magical moment, as was her performance generally, in which she won... on her 7th match point against Kasatkina, who not only ended the match heartbroken, so did poor old Matt, who picked her to win the title in our newsletter predictions, and must have thought you were on to a 75-point winner, Matt.
I did, and especially when I saw the head-to-head going in, which was two love to Kasatkina, except Kasatkina herself wasn't giving any credence to that at all. And she actually came out with the quote of the week, I think, saying that head-to-heads don't matter in finals, except maybe when it's Nadal and Gasquet.
fantastic.
That's so good.
So great.
Also withering.
Yes.
Yes, and truthful.
Most of the best withering stuff is. But yes. I tell you, that's a good win for Collins. Where is Collins now in the sort of the scenarios of the landscape of the WTA tour? Is she in the mix for the US Open?
Well,
she would be less of a surprise US Open winner than Krejcikova was a surprise French Open winner. But then equally, Krejcikova winning the French Open doesn't suddenly mean you just sort of throw everyone into the mix. It doesn't mean we can be willy-nilly about the mix.
doesn't
mix
usually stop us. Well, the thing is, if you look at the four biggest events this year in tennis, the Australian Open, the French Open, Wimbledon, and if you chuck in the Olympics as well, 16 different women have reached the semifinals of those events. Nobody has reached the semifinals at more than one of those events. So, yes, I think we've got this group emerging at the top and who are winning the big titles. But the opportunity is there for a lot of players to go deep in these tournaments. And I think Danielle Collins, on the sort of form she's in at the moment, you would have to think, depending on the draw, obviously, but you would have to think she's got a very good shot of going deep at the US Open, and that will probably put her in the mix. It's difficult to tell where Collins is at the moment because she's a completely different player. The fact that she's had the endometriosis surgery means for the first time in her career she can trust her body. And that must be so liberating. It's like a new career. I don't think we've ever really known what Collins is fully capable of because, in her words, it was impossible in the past for her to win back-to-back tournaments. You know, that just the pain was too much. And thank goodness she's now in a much better place with that, and we're seeing, I think, for the first time what she's capable of. Look, I mean, they weren't exactly the most stacked tournaments, you know, the best players in the world weren't there, but I think her game stands up when she's playing well. As you said, she ended that match with 54 winners to 7 for Kasatkina. It was an incredible display, and I don't think anyone wants to have to face that. You know, she's got the respect of Serena Williams, we know that. And I think when you have that, you have the respect of everyone in the game, and they know what she's capable of. So on her day, she's a match for anyone. And in the sort of form she's in at the moment, I think we have to be projecting forward to the US Open and thinking she could be in the mix there.
Oh, Matt, that was great.
it was great, but he concluded on the words "could be in the mix," which is fantastically vague.
I think I've learnt.
she beat Shelby Rogers, Sloane Stephens, Elena Rybakina, and these are good wins just to get to that final. I'm really surprised, looking at her record in the major tournaments, that the US Open is the weakest of them. For
really?
Her, by far. She's played it 6 times. She's only won one match. That compares to 7-3 in Australia, 7-4 at the French Open, 3-3 at Wimbledon, and 1-5 at the US Open, which is a tournament that, to me, is made for her in terms of atmosphere. If she could play in front of, start getting full crowds. I mean, this is a woman who came through college and loved those big occasions and would rise to them, I think. I think one of the issues, how much is she going to have left? How much has she tended to have left by the time the US Open has come around? Because it's such a long season until then. I really hope she can be at her best for that tournament, because New York and Danielle Collins are made for each other, as far as I'm concerned. So very, very interesting to see. So I think that just about does it for another tennis podcast at 1:44 a.m. on a sort of Tuesday morning. And Catherine really does need to go to bed ahead of day two of Amazon Prime Video's coverage that she'll be up for presenting tomorrow. I suppose I better go to bed as well, because my kids will be up in about 4 hours and wanting to go to breakfast. And Matt's just got the 2 hours of editing to come. So how are you looking forward to that, Matt? But it's been delightful. Thank you both for your company.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah. Right. Well, we'll be back again very soon.
Yes. It's weird when we don't do a podcast for a week. That feels like a really long time now.
It is
a
long time. Yeah. Thankfully, we have got another mascot for this week. And I've got a picture of Teddy, the 8-year-old cockapoo who lives in Wimbledon Village. Have you seen this picture, Catherine? This picture.
Well, I might have seen Teddy out on the common.
Well, actually, I'm told that you have met Teddy, Catherine.
What?
Yeah, I think a few years ago, before we, you know, really knew who Teddy was.
Tell me more.
here we go. We had the pleasure of meeting Catherine a few years ago when she was on her way to work at Wimbledon. We were on our way to the common, and I was listening to the podcast when I saw Catherine walking towards us. And she greeted the dogs, because, of course.
Totally ignored the humans.
This is all sounding...
very plausible.
Plausible, yeah. This definitely happened.
Teddy's great, Catherine. You're gonna feast your eyes on this photo of Teddy, the 8-year-old.
Oh, well, I hope that Billie Jean and I bump into Teddy on the common.
Indeed. And we've all got our own individual mascots. Scouse or Mousel for Matt, Rogue for me, Zeus for Catherine, and Scouse or Mousel, you were so nearly boosted by Matt in the predictions, and then he failed. So do sign up to the newsletter and find out who we mess up for in this week's tournament, in this week's stage of the tournament. Billie Jean King is the sponsor of Billie Jean the Dog. Is Billie Jean the Dog back home yet, Catherine? I haven't seen her knocking around.
She's not, no. She's in her custom-made bicycle basket, being ferried to and from the pub with my brother and his girlfriend.
Well, as long as she's having a good time, it's all I care
about. I think
about.
It's safe to say she's having a good time.
Oh, good. Okay.
She's also on Billie Jean King's Instagram story.
Yeah, she is. She's casually hanging out there as well.
Marvellous. Chris Albert Lee is our executive producer, and we will be back again on Thursday with a bit of an update with how Montreal/Toronto are going. See you then.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win. And support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.